Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everyone, to the New Books in History channel. This is a channel of New Books Network. My name is Jeanette Cockcroft, and I am the host of this channel. Today, I will be talking with Amy Absher, author of Fritzy, The Invented Life and Violent Murder of a Flapper. Please welcome Amy Absher to the program. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I am delighted. Let's start at the beginning. And who is Fritzy?
Fritzy Mann was about 20 years old when she was murdered in 1923. She was 4.5 months pregnant. She was an immigrant from Galicia in Europe, which is near kind of between Ukraine and Poland in the modern map. She was Jewish. She was a flapper. She danced in the San Diego nightclub scene.
And what do you mean by her invented life?
Well, her invented life happens sort of on multiple levels. So there's what she's doing for herself. She really believed in you fake it until you make it. She's told everyone she was a star. And she believed it, and she went out to try to make this career for herself as a flapper, as a dancer, as an icon of eroticism and beauty and performance. And she was going to be a star in silent films eventually. That was what she was setting out to do. She believed in positive thinking and just telling everybody what reality was, not accepting reality as it was. So she didn't go around telling people she was an immigrant and poor and her parents barely spoke English and she was Jewish. Instead, she went around telling people she was a star. And so it happens on that level, but eventually she becomes pregnant and that changes everything. And she can't necessarily pursue that career anymore. And she's trying to hide the reality that she's pregnant and trying to figure out what she wants to do. And so there's an invented, like, sort of mental level. You know, she hides it from the mother that she's pregnant. She hides it from her friends. She does everything she can to preserve the identity of Fritzy. And there's another kind of invented life, because after she's murdered, there are so many versions of her that are invented, as the people in the newspapers, you know, people writing for the newspapers, and district attorneys and defense attorneys, family and medical examiners, everyone tries to invent a story about who she was and what happened to her. And the stories that they invent help them to explain the 1920s and explain their society and their roles and their relationships to her. So her invented life happens on multiple levels.
While we're talking about her invented life, I'd like to explore her choice of labeling herself as an Oriental dancer. This is intriguing to me, because I know she's not the only one in the 20s who fixates on this. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's always, to me, humorous, because how the project started was I ran into a very short little blurb of an article in the New York Times in 1923 about her murder, that an Oriental dancer was found murdered on a beach in San Diego. And I thought they meant Asian American flapper. And I got really excited. And I emailed friends, and I was just like, Asian American murdered. Ah. It wasn't that kind of Oriental. It was, if you remember back to graduate school and we read Edward Said, which was never as exciting as Asian American flapper. Edward Said's book with, Orientalism, that's more what it's like. It's the Occidental versus the Oriental. And she picked up on this idea that there was a sort of a spectrum as she could explore in terms of identities and manipulate the audience's expectations of sexuality and eroticism. And she could change her body, which would have been labeled as society, as Jewish, devalued. But she could label it as something exotic and erotic and play with all of these ethnicities. And so part of why she's labeled Oriental dancer is that in her, when she's found, there's a small suitcase nearby that contains a kimono. And she would do performances as a geisha. She would do performances as a Turkish dancer, as a Spanish dancer, any kind of flexible kind of identity that she could use, makeup and costumes and beads and ostrich feathers and all of these 1920s things to change her identity. And actually she places newspaper ads. That's how I trace her through her life. I follow her performances and the ads that she places for her performances. And she will actually, about 6 months before she dies, she's telling people she's Turkish. She's copying Valentino, who's a big movie star at the time. In his dances, she has one performance where she performs as a bat and has apparently a wonderful bat costume and swoops around the stage. And you see her, and you think about how vampires and Nosferatu was really popular in the 1920s. Yes. And so she's capitalizing on that and creating and inventing herself through these performances. But the Oriental in the 1920s is very much, you think about, they just discovered King Tut's tomb, for example, and that's very exotic right. to them, the ancient Egyptians. So I think when we, unfortunately, the word Oriental is very problematic. So for people in the 1920s, it really was this looking at the racial other as something that they could become. They can put on the costume and they can alter their identity and stop being the Westerner and become the Easterner. And this is very powerful for her because as a Westerner, she is the least valued types of Westerners because she's yes. Jewish, she's an immigrant. Her parents are coming, you know, they came to Colorado first and then to California. Her sister has tuberculosis. That's one of the reasons they come to California is the hospitals and the sunshine and the sun-kissed oranges and health food. And so there's this sickness that the European sick immigrant, there's all of these things that she's baggage that she's carrying with her. And she's shedding all of that by becoming more Oriental. But in the Oriental, she's completely in charge of her body and she's completely in charge of her identity. And she can control that audience because the audience is coming to her for that erotic other experience. That puts her in a position of power she wouldn't have in that way, probably.
Indeed. And the other half of this, of course, is her violent death. So what exactly happens?
See, well, she is pregnant. She actually places an ad in the newspaper and has a final performance in San Diego. And she tells everyone she's going to Los Angeles, that she has a film contract with Lasky's Famous Players, which becomes Paramount, which is like a big deal.
Yeah.
This is a big studio. And she's going to be performing in nightclubs all over Studio City and Los Angeles. And she's finally made it. She's a starlet. But really, she's pregnant and she's not married. And she's escaping to go to Los Angeles, to Long Beach, the not very exotic Long Beach, California, to stay with her childhood friend, Bernice. And one of her lovers, who's presumed by the police to be the father of the child because he goes to great arrange an abortion for her, is sending like an abortion fixer because it's hard to arrange an abortion. You have to have someone that knows how to have an abortion to help you contact the right people. And so he's sending this woman to Los Angeles to track her down and to meet with her. And Percy Mann is trying to figure out if she wants to go that way. And she's dodging this woman who's trying to find her. She's on an amazing adventure of what do you do as a pregnant woman in 1922, end of 1922. And she decides to go back to San Diego and face this man and demand of the people around her that they accept her decision and what she wants to do. She feels like she's been treated poorly. This is all in her letters and her telegrams to her friends. And so she tells her mother she's going to a party. She's going to meet up with movie producers and movie people at a fabulous Hollywood party. And she's a very good girl because she calls her mother to tell her that the location of the party changed.
Yes.
And she's instead, you know, she's going to, you know, outside of La Jolla and that kind of thing. And we're going, Mom, we're going to, she was such a good girl. She was such a thoughtful daughter. But what she ends up doing is going to a sort of roadside hotel with a man, and that man drowns her in the bathtub of the hotel. This we know because of her lungs had domestic water and Nazi water, but she wasn't found when she didn't walk out into the surf on the beach to kill herself, as many believed at that time. She was killed in that hotel room, and the maid said that she found sort of brownish water in the tub. It wasn't clear water, and a little bit of water was left in the tub, and it was brown. And whoever was in the hotel room had hung up the towels, and there were two, it was a kitchenette, and there were two glasses on the washboard, and Fritzi's sort of barrette was found in the room, and a bottle of liquor, and things like that. And so the police and medical examiner were fairly certain that she was drowned. And what happened, she had a bruise and a lump contusion on her forehead, so probably someone smacked her head into the tub and helped them hold her down. And the condition of her lungs showed that she struggled with the person who was doing that, that she didn't go willingly into that good night, as the poem says, that she resisted. And so it is a violent death, isn't it? Because it was probably the lover who killed her. It's a very intimate domestic setting, yes, in the hotel room, which was probably where they met up frequently. And she holds someone under the water until they drown, as they try not to drown, because your body doesn't want to die. Your body will do everything it can to survive, especially in a drowning situation.
Yeah.
It's a very hard way to kill someone, but it's also a very violent and intimate way to kill someone. You have to really want to kill them to hold them under the water, I think. She was always the girl that wasn't what she was supposed to be, right? And so he wanted her dead. That was what he wanted, and he made it happen. She had resisted everything in her life up to that point. She had been the author of the narrative up until that point. And the death takes that away from her and murder in that power and agency she had over herself.
And let's talk about the trials, right? There are two trials. So who is tried for this murder? And what is this trial like?
Louis Jacobs, yeah. Louis Jacobs is going to be put on trial twice. He's also indicted by a grand jury, and he's very much indicted by the press. He has a trial in the media as well. They very much think he's guilty as well. But he is dapper, tall, handsome, physician. So he's a catch. He's Jewish like she is. His family were immigrants. They have been up and coming in two law degrees and full degrees in the Midwest. He's come out to San Diego to work in the hospital in Balboa Park. He's a physician in the health services, and he works in cardiology and pulmonology. And he's very, his letters and telegrams make him seem very self-centered. He's very come in San Diego because in addition to Fritzi Mann, he's also sort of dating wealthy older women, chauffeuring them around, being there on Gandhi. He's working the social network, and he's also dating Fritzi Mann, poor immigrant, you know, who's pregnant. So if he is the person who killed her, which is what the police and everyone else except the jury believed, there's a reason, there is a motive, and it's about class, and it's about access, and it's about rising up in society. So we can't have this poor Jewish mother who dresses like a bat and a geisha, and she dances for the Navy. Like, the Navy officers have parties, and she performs at those parties, and really well known in San Diego, and may not be white, right? She is very body proud. She's in control of her sexuality. She knows what she wants. She is kind of dangerous for him.
Yes.
He needs probably other different kind of woman. Yes. He prefers wealthy married women who are older, who can bring him to parties and to events. So Fritzi is the inconvenience of life. That is what they say his motive is. And he's also the person sending her all the telegrams about how to get an abortion and that she needs to get one. And why didn't you meet Why didn't you meet up? Why didn't you make this appointment? Why didn't you have the abortion? And that's that. He said he's just being altruistic and a really good friend, but no one is that good of a friend. No one.
I think not.
Yeah. So he does. He. No, but his sexuality is different, right? So he's playing the field and he's promiscuous too. But that's not a problem for the jury, the attorney, people like that. That's the defense attorney. They're like, they're saying, like, well, Fritzy Mann was a gold digger. Fritzy Mann was, you know, out to score, this prominent husband. She was, you know, she couldn't do it, so she killed herself. She wasn't murdered. So her sexuality is very much called into question and impugned in society because of the gender roles and the class roles. And his is the district attorney, definitely, the prosecutors definitely question it, but the jury will eventually not believe he's guilty. They will believe that, you know, she probably harmed herself.
Now, in the book, you say that there are three female witnesses whose testimony is discounted because of these issues of class, right? Blanche Jones, Mrs. Worthington, and then Fritzy's mother, Mrs. Mann.
Well, I don't think Mrs. Worthington's is discounted. Mrs. Worthington is the wealthy older woman that Louis Jacobs is escorting around. She doesn't drive. She needs very attractive young men to drive her places. Monica can get it, I guess, right? But she
that's what I was thinking.
Because she always knows what time anything happened at, where everyone was standing, what they were wearing. She has a wonderfully detailed memory for cataloging events and love. And she says that he drove her to Tijuana, which is out a little bit south of San Diego, if you remember, then that's very close, right across the border. And because it's prohibition, does everyone drive to San Diego? Because that's where you can drink with weed, and there's horse racetracks, and there's nightclubs, and there's jazz. Some of the best jazz musicians of the 20th century are in Tijuana performing at that time. And I don't think she's discounted. She is that very, very wealthy and glamorous woman of middle age. But the attorneys ask her like different questions. They don't ask her about her sex life. They just ask her things like what time it is and what was address and who else was there. So there's a certain amount of social respect for Mrs. Worthington.
Yes.
But she is discounted in that no one is seeing her, I guess, as a sexual being. That kind of relationship isn't what they're interested in. So I think I can see what you mean, that there is a devaluation of her as a full person. But as a witness, she's spectacular. But interesting because she doesn't talk about him in any sort of active verbs. She talks about him in the past, so he no longer exists for her. So he no longer has access to that world, if you look at the way she says things. But the woman, a middle-aged, upper-class woman, sends her daughter to finishing school, has multiple homes. She is living a bit in a cage. She doesn't have all of the social freedom she would like to have, which is probably spelled out by the fact that she doesn't know how to drive. You know, men have to take care of her, and so she has to perform a social role. As opposed to Blanche Jones, who is in some ways incredibly heroic, because she wasn't part of the first trial. She is a nurse at the same hospital where Jacobs worked, and she knew him at that hospital. And she is married, she has a small child, and she's working, so she's a working mother. Her husband is somewhat convalescing. It's after World War I, so a lot of men are ill with various things, and it's unclear what's going on in her marriage. But she's a nurse at this hospital, and there's a patient she's become friends with, and she takes him out for drives at night. They go out to look at the ocean, to talk, to converse, and they see an automobile and a driver that look like Louis Jacobs. And because she works there and knows his car and has a very snazzy Hudson, it's a very expensive car and it's very noticeable what it is. And she knows him. She sees like his kind of silhouette, just a little, you know, him sort of through like a window. It's not like she has, it's not daytime, it's night. So it's right. A little bit, see how she keeps it again. But she is really discounted because she is kind of having this affair with this patient from work. She didn't come forward in first trial, but when first trial he isn't found guilty, she feels that weight that she has to come forward and say something because someone was murdered. This is a doctor. He's supposed to take care of people. There's a whole lot of ethical dilemmas here.
Yes.
But she knows coming forward, she's basically ruining her marriage. And if they end up getting divorced, she's not going to get custody of her child in 1923. That's not how divorce worked at the time. The men would always get the children. And she could lose her job because, I mean, she's taking patients out for moonlight strolls along the beach. Well, drives along the beach. So this is, she's really casting her life upon the rocks, right?
Yes.
She is putting herself out there to say, I saw this. There's very little for her to gain from this situation other than the fact that she saw this and she wants to tell the truth. But she is destroyed in the media, in court. I mean, they've really raked her over the coals. And the patient that is called, the one that she takes for the drive, and he's just asked about names of streets and times of evening. He's not asked about his sexuality or if they have, you know, what the, either they don't really even stress the nature of the relationship. And with her, it is very much, you are married, you are a nurse, you are a mother. So Blanche Jones is very much cast out. There's also a huge disagreement about the names of roads and where she was at and that kind of thing. So the defense really is able to destroy her as a witness pretty easily. And the third is, you're right, it's Fitzy Mann's mother, Amelia Mann, who is an immigrant, a widow. English is her second language. And they are very cruel to her in court. The judge, she needs things repeated for her. What does that word mean? That kind of thing. And the judge is very, well, judgmental of her asking that, you know, she's trying to mess up the lawyers or something. She has some sort of plot. And widows at the time are very suspect. They're suspicious because they are knowledgeable women and they have no husbands. They have no real social standing because, you know, Mrs. Worthington is Mrs. Worthington, her husband, you know, that gives her that status. And Blanche Jones, she's violating her marriage. So you see that she's violating the thing that she's supposed to be in society and where her identity is supposed to come from. Amelia Mann doesn't have any of that. She is a widow and she's older and the defense wants to prove, they can't really get at Fitzy Mann and prove that she's like slutty and that kind of thing.
Right.
So they do it to her mother, like they yell at her mother and make her seem that she's a bad mother, that she didn't know her daughter was having sex and pregnant. And she didn't know her daughter was going around seeing all of these men. And Amelia Mann is there to defend her daughter's honor and to say that happened, you know, that she walked her daughter to the streetcar station and when her daughter was leaving for the party that last night. And her daughter called her to tell her she was going with these people and that kind of thing. Her daughter packed. The son of her clothing was never recovered. And if the defense is right and she walked down the beach to commit suicide, then would all of her daughter have been on the beach? Probably. But a lot of her articles are missing. A lot of her articles of intimate clothing are missing and that kind of thing. And so they sort of use her mother as a vessel or a candidate for Fitzy Mann. Destroyed. And so these are sort of the three archetypical women, right? You have the working mother, you have the wealthy woman, and then you have the, and you can see how society sees all these different types of women. And the story of Fitzy Mann is very much a story about all the women in the 1920s, early 1920s.
As we run out of time, there is one last thing I want to touch on briefly. And it's this uptick in crime and the obsession that people have with it in the 20s.
Well, what are you thinking? Are you thinking about the perpetration of violence, or are you thinking about something else?
No, I'm thinking of the tabloids. I'm thinking about some of the high-profile rape cases in Hollywood or accusations of rape.
Right. So in the 1920s, there's the Roscoe Arbuckle trial, and he's the biggest comedian in Hollywood movies at the time. He's a spectacular physical comedy practitioner, and they wrap a movie and they go to San Francisco for a weekend party. Lots of illegal liquor, lots of everything else that's illegal, and a young woman dies at a party, and it's horrific. And so this is everywhere in the media, and Quincy Mass Murder actually beats it back for a while out of the headlines, and you're competing for all the headlines, and newspapers are putting out all these crimes and all these murders to get the subscribers and the people to buy newspapers. They promote the murders and they promote the trials. And Arbuckle has three trials, so it's huge news because you don't know how a trial is going to end, so it's suspenseful for the reader. And so it becomes very obsessive. He's acquitted in the end. He doesn't get back his career. He doesn't get back anything that he had. And there's a horrible social stigma that because once you're in the newspaper, you're always in the newspaper. It never goes away.
Yeah.
So people say these things about you. And this is what people think of when they think of Roscoe Arbuckle, is this trial. And there's a lot of other murders all over the United States. And people will get in their cars on the weekend, they'll drive out to a scene of where a murder happened, and they'll look for souvenirs they can take from the murder scene, you know, with the police investigating. And so they'll get shingles off houses. They'll get into, you know, people. It's amazing how people behave about murders. And so they collect things of murders. They collect the mug shots of the killers. They gather outside the gates of penitentiaries when people are going to be executed. And there's people outside of the gates of penitentiaries to the crowd. They want to get to the trials. So they have to actually print tickets and give them out at the door so that only a certain number will be seen in a courtroom, right?
Yeah.
And so Fritzy Mann's trial is like that. Not her trial. Louis Jacobs' trials are like that. And so there's a ton of young, beautiful women that come to the trial to flirt with Louis Jacobs while he's on trial for killing Fritzy Mann.
Amy,
they're so in love with the idea of murder. Yes. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
To tell you about murder.
I love it. But sadly, we are almost out of time. So I want to thank you so much for this wonderful discussion. I think people will enjoy this book, and I am so grateful, as I said, for a very lively discussion. Thank you so much.